Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, this weekend edition on 101.3 KPCG. How is that vote recount going in Wisconsin? We've got some details about that. There's a shock poll that's come out from British Muslims. What do they want? It's pretty interesting. There's a school that may ban some classic books. Interesting to see what you think about that. And France has new leadership on the way. That and more stories coming up this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for being with us today. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and send us an email as you'd like to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk. Grant Turgeon here today. Grant, we had a sort of a humorous email sent to us yesterday from one of our listeners. They were referencing, I think it was Wednesday's program, where I mentioned it was cold in the studio, and I was glad that you showed up and that Abraham Blondo came later because it warmed the studio. And the lady said, she asked if it was a reference to you guys being full of hot air. And I said, no, I never thought of it that way, but she was astute.
We were huddling for warmth.
It was just the warmth, the natural warmth that comes from having multiple bodies within a enclosed room. So she was having a little fun with that. So we appreciated that email, and we appreciate all those that come into KPCG. Comments at kpcg.fm. Well, they're recounting the votes up there in Wisconsin. How much did that cost? Do you remember? A couple million, a few million dollars?
Well, Jill Stein raised $5 million, but it was for three different state recounts, okay. So I don't know how much this one cost, probably around $1
million. Okay, so it's costing a fair bit, and it says Trump defeated Clinton in Wisconsin's initial tally by about 1% or just over 22,000 votes, and as you mentioned, the Green Party candidate Jill Stein, green for money apparently, finished a very distant fourth. She's demanding a full recount after suggesting fraud or technological glitches that may have swayed the results. Drum roll, please. In response to the demand, Wisconsin began recounting all its ballots Thursday, and there's a one vote difference. So, yeah, Hillary Clinton got one more vote, actually. So, well worth it. Now, there's more to count still, but
it made a difference already. We can hard tell.
I don't know. I think Jill Stein got a few more. And then who was the other candidate?
Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson. I think he got a few more, too. I don't know if that helps them, if they can have a little. I don't think that it would, but I don't know. Maybe they can use that to their advantage for some reason. Just a lot of money to put into something that I think everybody knows the result of before they even start. One vote difference. What difference does it make at this point? At this point, what difference does it make?
We turn that statement around on her then.
That's what Hillary Clinton always says. In relation to the election, I find this to be a misleading headline from the Washington Post. They're still salty about the loss of their candidate. Maybe the Washington Post was running for vice president. Were they going to be the vice president under Hillary Clinton?
The whole paper.
The entire, yeah. They say Donald Trump will be president thanks to 80,000 people in three states. That's a bit of a misleading headline. It's not just 80,000 people. It's the other millions that also voted for Donald Trump as well.
Right.
To make it out like it's, yeah, there's a difference about that, but that's a little bit of a misleading headline, I think.
Yeah, it really is. They're exploring every option to try to make Hillary Clinton the president, even still, with that recount effort that has so far proved fruitless. Who knows? Maybe that could change. But also, a lot of liberals are sending death threats to the Electoral College voters, and there is a movement within the Electoral College itself for a lot of those people to switch. I believe 37 electors would actually need to switch for that to happen. Only 7 so far have said that they would.
That would be interesting to see. I don't think that'll actually happen. Why don't they just pretend that she won? Just pretend. I mean, most of what they write is pretend. So just keep pretending.
Well, apparently the last stage of grief is acceptance, and they haven't quite gotten there yet, but maybe in a few years they'll get to that point, and then it'll be over.
It's a recovery program. It's no more
rioting at that point.
It's a 12-step. They're only on step, whatever, 5 or 6. Yeah, interesting. So they're still talking about it. I thought it was kind of resolved and over with, and everyone was moving on with life, but they keep bringing it back up.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like a lot of those people should be at least put at ease by the way Mr. Trump has handled himself since gaining the victory, and yet they're still very upset. He's appointed a lot of good people who they have immediately branded as racist instead of realizing that they're highly qualified.
Yeah. And that ties into a story that you've got later about the Trump camp and the Clinton camp still kind of going after each other. So we'll talk about that a little later on. Here's an interesting story. Parents disarm their son who brought guns to Utah school. We've seen a trend, unfortunately, over the last 20 years, I guess, or so, of school violence with weapons. It says two fast-acting parents disarmed their 15-year-old son at a Utah junior high school Thursday after they noticed the teenager acting strangely in the morning and realized he had taken the family shotgun and handgun, police said. The mother and father arrived shortly after the boy entered a classroom in the northern Utah city of Bountiful and fired one round into the ceiling. Didn't injure anyone, but it left a hole in the ceiling. The suspect also pointed the shotgun at his own neck. The boy didn't say a word as a teacher and one of 26 students tried to talk him out of firing the gun again, giving his parents a few extra seconds to arrive at the classroom and take him into the hallway, and they were able to take care of the situation. So, strange deal, but at least the parents knew something was wrong and went and fixed the problem to some point at least.
Right, that's a very vigilant couple there to realize that the guns are gone and to then assume the worst, which is a lot of times what parents need to do, or else the kids could go horribly off course, it seems like.
Yeah, so clearly something wrong with this kid. He's going through some problem or something's going on. They have to figure that out. So who knows what his home life is like. But the fact that, like you say, the parents noticed something's not right with him and then were quick to act and could take care of it themselves, that I think is pretty, I don't know what you'd say, positive, I guess. That they at least were paying attention and they at least knew, like, hey, something's not right with him. What's going on? And then they saved, well, probably the kid's own life and maybe some other people as well. Police said the boy had walked into the Mueller Park Junior High with a shotgun and two boxes of ammo under a long trench coat type jacket concealing the weapons. That seems to be the jacket of choice for those things, I guess, just to cover it up. He did not point the shotgun at any other students, so I don't know if this was like a really outlandish cry for help for himself, or what. There was a story that's been in the news the last couple of days where a girl, she killed herself in front of her family from being bullied online. So I don't know the details of this particular situation here, but sometimes kids get bullied or they have problems and they react way too extremely like this guy.
Yeah, that's terrible. This story is a pretty big contrast to a lot of these stories where the school shooting actually happens, not just because this shooting didn't happen, but because the parents acknowledged that the kid was going off course. A lot of the time after the fact, the reporters will interview the parents of the school shooters, and the parents will say, I had no idea anything was wrong with them
right. The
whole time. And it's like they were oblivious. They had no insight into their children's world. And that's why the shooting was even allowed to happen in the first place.
Yeah, I think that was I don't know if you want to say the good side to the story, but the more positive side was that the parents were paying attention. And they were there in the morning. They saw him. Hey, something's not right here.
Something's not right this one morning, because apparently they see him every morning,
right,
which you can't say about a lot of parents if their kids just go on the bus and never see their parents at all.
Right. So, of course, we don't know all the details, but I think it does highlight just that if you have at least the parents around and they are paying attention and they have some basic concern, you can avoid a lot of problems, and just their actions maybe save some people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the interesting thing, because a lot of times those conversations are about guns and gun violence. But really, I think the conversation should be about the home life and the families and the parental structure there because that'll prevent a lot of problems. You know, 15 years old, you can have some wacky ideas. Usually it's not that extreme, but things get blown out of proportion. You're getting picked on. You react to it in a very strong way. And sometimes you need adults there to say, hey, well, you always need adults there to say, hey, you're taking it too far.
Yeah, in this case, what saved lives? Obviously, the kid already had the guns. He had already brought them to school, and he could have shot them. But because of diligent parenting, because of parents who were actually involved in their children's lives, this story didn't turn out a lot worse.
Yeah, and they didn't give a lot of the details that I saw anyway. But the fact that the parents came to the school and were able to, I think, take the kid out in the hallway and like basically disarm him. That says something about the relationship. Like, he at least respected them enough to listen to what they said. So that's another angle, too, I think.
Because if he had the gun and it's the gun's fault, apparently he wouldn't be able to control it from pointing at people and shooting people. But it's not the gun's fault. We always blame the gun after a tragedy like this instead of the person and the mind change that led to something like that.
Yeah, and clearly something happened to him because the parents noticed, boy, something's different with him today. So anyway, a bad story, but sort of a positive ending in a sense that there weren't people injured. But there is a lot of violence in the United States. Chicago tops 700 homicides for the year. There have been 701 so far, and we're heading into, of course, the weekend, and unfortunately the weekend seems to be there's always more people killed, it seems like. But there have been 701 homicides recorded so far this year in the city. The Chicago Police Department told CNN on Thursday there were 480 homicides in 2015. So just to compare and contrast there. It's the first time the city has recorded more than 700 homicides in nearly two decades, according to the Chicago Tribune. Chicago had 704 homicides in 1998. The Tribune reported, and is on pace to easily break that mark. So they're looking at potentially a record year in a bad way up there in Chicago.
That's terrible. It's almost to the point where maybe they should just evacuate the whole city. And those who stay behind, they can deal with, I guess, the law however they want to. But clearly, innocent people are being victimized there all the time, and maybe they should just get out.
Some people are, those that can. We talked about that a while ago, where people that had the resources to get out, they do. And that's what happens in a lot of cities. People that can afford to get out, they do get out because it becomes violent. There's other problems. And so, but a lot of people are stuck. They can't really go anywhere, and they're dealing with these situations. I just thinking back over the year to some of the stories we've highlighted from Chicago, you know, in a lot of cases, it's been drug violence, inner city violence. And a lot of the people shot were just minding their own business. They just happened to be in the wrong part of town. Sometimes they were into trouble that led to the shooting. But there are cases where people are in their houses, you know, and the bullets come through the house and kill children. So it's a horrible situation there.
We had that story on a previous program about a family that moved to Chicago and left, I believe, the same day or the very next day because they saw how bad it was. Maybe they didn't realize how bad it was until they got there. But that just kind of shows you this city has some serious problems that need to be dealt with instead of blaming guns all the time, especially.
Yeah. Got to clean up we got to get rid of the drugs. Mm-hmm. You've got to get rid of the crime. And how do you do it? You know, it's a tough thing for people to do without taking some serious action. So, and I think I would guess, I don't know all the numbers, but I would guess most of it's drug related, gang related. And even the gang-related stuff, I mean, most of those gangs are involved in drugs. That's where they make their money. So a lot of issues there. So that's an unfortunate thing there in Chicago, and that's just one city in the U.S.
And where are the gang members getting their guns to shoot each other? That's another issue. Do you think a gang member is getting his gun legally?
Well, right, and that's the thing. If gun laws are imposed, the only people that follow them are people that follow the law, and they're not the ones shooting people. So it's kind of one of those arguments, I think, that the anti-gun argument that kind of falls flat because the people that are using them illegally aren't going to follow laws. If you're willing to murder somebody, you don't care about the smaller laws, if you want to call them that. So pretty interesting. There's a poll that they did over in the UK. This is from The Express. Shock poll, they say. 4 in 10 British Muslims want some aspect of Sharia law enforced in the UK. They've come to the UK, but they have not left their beliefs. They still think that they should have Sharia law.
It's pretty interesting because a lot of the time when we hear Muslim apologists, they say that there's just a tiny minority that have extreme viewpoints. Now, this is a minority, but 30 or 40% of the people, that's not a really tiny minority at all.
No, and you have to wonder if everyone was being honest, too, because, you know, it doesn't mean everybody was telling their exact mind on it. They say 43% of followers of the religion of Islam living in the country of the UK there believed that parts of the Islamic legal system should replace British law, while only 22% opposed the idea. I wonder if they asked any women about that. You don't want to be under Sharia law if you're a woman, I don't think.
Not at all. It must have been all men responding, or maybe the six who said no were only women.
Yeah. It's interesting. Researchers also found deeply worrying levels of belief among British Muslims in conspiracy theories such as blaming the U.S. government or the Jews for the 9/11 terror attacks on America. They think that in some cases.
I saw a news segment the other night where there was an apologist on there saying that Islamophobia caused that attack in Ohio State earlier this week because he felt like he wasn't being treated well because he's a Muslim, but that somehow justifies him running people over in his car and stabbing people. There's never a justification for that. And that's the same with even the school shootings we talk about. You know, the right course of action is not to bring a gun to your school and shoot it up if you get bullied. And the same thing here. Just because you don't think you're treated right in any situation, whatever it may be, violence is never going to be the right answer.
No. That's some circular reasoning there, to say the least.
And why are people afraid of Muslims in the first place?
Right.
We have to kind of get back to the root cause, the belief system that has been tainted.
They say here that the findings were revealed just last evening in one of the biggest surveys of opinion among Muslims ever carried out in the UK. Data from the polling firm ICM showed very similar views to the rest of the UK population on a range of key issues, including the NHS, unemployment, and immigration. So they have some similar views until it comes to Sharia law and a few other things. This one's not good. Listen to this one. 48% would not turn to the police if someone close to them became involved with people linked to Syrian terrorism. Those are the ones that admit it. Almost half said, yeah, if I knew they were into terrorism, I wouldn't say anything.
Right. The apologists I saw on TV the other night cited some sort of statistic where in the U.S., the most people or most people who turn in potential terrorists are Muslims. But the immediate question is, well, how many more terrorists could have been stopped if the entire community was loyal to the country instead of to possibly the terrorist and his ideology? I mean, really, a lot more people have been able to hide out in Muslim communities in Europe, in America, before they go out and commit the terrorist act. And most of the people around them know what's about to happen, and they don't say anything.
Yeah, that's true. Even with the Ohio State situation, they interviewed some of the neighbors, which I think it was a white lady. So, and she's like, oh, yeah, I saw him doing this and this and this. But, yeah, I don't know. I didn't think much of it. And she didn't say anything. But, you know, in fairness to her or to really a lot of people, you would have a kind of a fear of persecution if you said something. And, you know, you accuse them of something. They weren't doing anything. So I think there's a fear for anybody to report something just because they don't want to be called racist or something like that.
That really is true. So we can't necessarily single out a Muslim community for not telling every time when they should maybe possibly tell. But really, a lot of those people are not telling, not because they're afraid of retribution, but right, because they actually agree with the terrorist atrocity that's about to take place.
Right. And the other big difference would be, like the lady they were interviewing about Ohio State, you know, she didn't know the people. She just saw something and thought, oh, that looks strange. Whereas in this case, they said, but if you knew, like you knew these people and you knew they were doing this, would you say something? They said 48% said no, wouldn't say anything.
Right. Friends, family members, people who know a lot about the terrorists but don't bother to tell because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to betray their family, but they also don't want to betray sometimes their radicalized views.
Yeah. So it's interesting, and that's just a survey that's come out there in the UK. They are having to deal with some of those situations because of the the integration. And that's it. That's a problem in Europe, and that's it's a problem in the U.S. as well. Here's an interesting write-up from Heat Street. Virginia school district bans To Kill a Mockingbird and Huck Finn over racial slurs. Did you ever have to read those books? You remember reading those?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wonderful books. Probably a couple of the very best we did read in school.
Yeah, we read Huckleberry Finn in, I think, eighth grade. And we read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was a sophomore, I believe, in high school. So, yeah, I remember reading those books. I don't remember, you know, every little detail about them. I remember them being interesting stories. And if anything, I remember it being pretty anti-slavery, pro-minority. I remember them that way more than being a racial slur type of issue.
Right. I believe in the case of Huck Finn, he had a slave, I think, but he actually treated him really well, or he had a slave friend who he considered as an equal and as a friend. Mm-hmm. So, yes, slavery might have existed at the time, but the way that the slaves were treated in those books was not necessarily discriminatory.
Right, and I think the point of the books in a lot of cases is that it's a snapshot of American history. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a time period. It's looking at that time period in history, talking about it in the way that they would at the time. But I think the lesson in both of the books is, especially like say To Kill a Mockingbird, that, I mean, that was the dad who was the lawyer. I mean, he was defending a black man, and it wasn't popular to do. So it was highlighting some of those minority cases in a positive way for the general readership. And that's what I remember about them.
Right. It's almost like they're saying because slaves exist in these books that the author is automatically endorsing slavery. Couldn't you say that about any form of entertainment? If there's a mass killer in a movie that the director favors mass killings, I mean, it's just a ridiculous form of logic. It's just part of the story. Just read the story and enjoy what it has to say.
And I think Mark Twain is kind of known as being a pretty good realist and kind of pointing out the hypocrisy in, say, society at his time period. It seems like he's known for that. But anyway, here are the details about it. They say a Virginia school district has temporarily banned the classics. They're discussing whether to keep them banned or not. After a parent complained that her high school-age son, who is biracial, was traumatized. He was traumatized by racial slurs used in the books. Not sure what he means by being traumatized there, but that's what they said happened. They said the parent, whose son, again, is biracial, told school administrators that the two Toms' use of racial slurs was excessive. So I don't, you know, if they said it once, would that be okay? I don't know. And that she questioned their literary value. She also felt that teenagers weren't mature enough to put the terms in context. They weren't mature enough, which I find to be a very interesting thing to say, considering the things that teens expose themselves to or are exposed to today. You know, whether or not a person likes these books or not, that's kind of I guess it's an issue they could discuss. But if her complaint is that, well, the teens can't handle that, you mean to tell me they can handle the movies that are out there, the violent video games that are out there, all the things that they get into on the internet? They can handle that. That's okay, but they can't handle looking at a time period of American history. I would venture to say that if her son or other teenagers put down the video game, got off the internet, put away the smartphone, and they read Huckleberry Finn, I think they would be better off at the end of that than putting the book aside and going back to their other things.
By far. And really what this mother seems to be talking about is the fact that maybe the word Negro or even worse terms are used. At least in the books like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, those words are not even used in a derogatory way. That's just what black people were called back then, just like white people were called whites or whatever else. It wasn't even meant to be offensive in those books. Now, in To Kill a Mockingbird, maybe so, but that was highlighting that there were a lot of racist people back then. The good guy in the story was the only person who was defending the wrongfully accused black man. So the good guy in the story is on the black person's side. It's not like the good guy is against blacks.
And it's interesting because, I mean, there are some slurs used in these books, again, that were, I guess, more common at that time. What about the music today? What about some of the music that's out there today? Are there any slurs used in some of those? You mean to tell me this guy, this kid who's traumatized, what does he listen to? Is he strictly like a Beethoven Bach guy, or is he like Drake and Kanye West and Jay-Z? And I don't know anything about him. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But I'm just thinking about people that age group or whoever's popular today. I don't really know all of them. What are they listening to? Are they traumatized by that? I mean, if we're talking about being traumatized, I think that's where it gets ridiculous.
And those musicians are using the exact same words that you will find in those books.
And worse.
And a lot worse. And it's just interesting because I think the justification for that a lot of the time is that if you are black, you can call black people derogatory names about their race. But if you're not, then you can't. So apparently the people in the book don't fit the right qualifications to use the words. But certain people can use the words, which must mean that maybe the words aren't as offensive as they're trying to make out.
It's just interesting how some things are picked on and other things are allowed to go. Comments from some of the readers of this write-up, one of them says, both of these books are masterpieces. Huckleberry Finn was one of the greatest anti-slavery books ever written. To Kill a Mockingbird changed the attitudes of millions of 20th century Americans. So it's an interesting discussion. There are things out there in the books that you read in school that aren't the best, no doubt. But to make a big issue out of it, while other things are allowed to just go on all the time, music, entertainment, so forth, that's where it seems to be pretty hypocritical.
Exactly. To Kill a Mockingbird is really an inspiring book to see one man stand up for someone he doesn't even know, because he knows he was wrongfully accused of a crime, and to see that man then really suffer professionally as a lawyer because everyone sees him as the traitor, the person who is defending this guy who is clearly guilty when he actually isn't. I mean, he's making tremendous personal sacrifice to help a black man, and that is actually, it's something that gave me chills when I read it, and it just kind of shows the kind of mindset that we all should have, being colorblind and helping people just because it's the right thing to do, not because the skin color is the same.
Right. Yeah. So those are, it's interesting. Of course, there's other books that are on that list as well that they want to ban, including the Bible.
Well, there you go. That says it all.
And there are some books that are allowed, including ones that have some pretty graphic depictions of things I won't even mention. So it's interesting when people pick and choose.
Until recently, though, the liberals will at least just put a trigger warning before their controversial material.
Right.
Now they're just banning it outright. It's gotten even worse.
My guess is, here's what I think really happened with a lot of these situations. I think the teens just don't want to read the books, and they know that if they bring up something like this, it'll get them out of doing their homework. And they can maybe write an essay about how they feel that day.
Could you imagine a 17-year-old boy actually being traumatized by reading the book, just breaking down in tears, yeah, and then getting into the fetal position under his bed?
What's wrong?
It's just unbelievable to even think that could be possible.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, I think the whole school district and the parents are being played.
Exactly.
And the kids are laughing, and they're going back to their smartphones. Here's a really interesting thing if you like giant snakes. Ravenous 14-foot python caught with 3 deer in its gut. It ate 3 deer, a Burmese python in the Everglades. With a penchant for venison, gulped down 3 whole deer, 1 doe, and 2 fawns. And they killed the snake and found him inside.
It's incredible.
Huge. They said that sets a record, as far as what they know. In the first, it's the first invasive Burmese python caught with 3 deer in its gut. And the co-leader of the study says, who is an associate professor of biology in Pennsylvania, verified that. So, yeah, you find some things in those giant snakes. It's and then, of course, the comments were funny. One guy just wrote Monty Python.
What? So, did they cut the snake open? How exactly?
Yeah.
Okay.
They knew there was something in there, I guess, and they killed it, and then they cut it open, and they found 3 deer in there.
I was wondering if maybe they could see the outline of 3 gigantic deer
inside
of the body just sticking out.
They may have. I mean, they do. It takes a long time for them to digest.
Yeah.
So it's amazing what those snakes can eat. Those things are terrifying.
And they just swallow them whole. I mean, they don't chew it.
Yeah. They just unhinge their jaw and just eat that thing. And I can't imagine walking through the woods and coming upon that like midway through. You're like, I'm just going to leave you to it.
Yeah, run for your life.
I'm just surprised the deer couldn't get away. Like, how does it sneak up on him?
I don't know.
They're so fast, you think they could take off. But once it gets you, you're not getting out of that.
Maybe they don't see the snake, and the snake just stays really still and then takes a bite out of the leg once the deer gets close enough.
It's a bad way to go. You know, you don't want to be in that situation.
Because don't they wrap themselves around the victim as well? And it's just like basically crush the insides of the victim basically until it can't breathe and it's helpless.
Yeah, I mean, those snakes are like just one solid muscle. And from what I understand, they wait for you to exhale and then they just tighten.
Right.
And they just keep tightening and tightening until you suffocate and then it swallows you. So anyway, be careful out there if you're in the Everglades. here's five everyday activities that burn the most calories. I thought this would be kind of interesting because everyone's trying to get a little more exercise in. Sometimes you can't do it, you know, get into the sweatpants and go running around. But here's some common activities that burn the most calories. Number one is grocery shopping, which is good. People go grocery shopping. But I did think there are a lot of people that you see just riding around in the grocery store. They don't walk anymore. Sometimes because they're older, sometimes just something else is going on.
And it can burn calories, but if you go to the grocery store when you're hungry, you're going to make a lot of regrettable purchases and then probably gain those calories right back.
Right, so you got to be careful. Second everyday activity that helps burn the most calories is painting, and I'm not talking about portraits. It's like painting your walls or, you know, fences, things like that. I don't know if that's an everyday activity. Thirdly, general cleaning. They say if you're cleaning up and getting the house clean, that burns a lot of calories. It's funny, they said if you sweep for 30 minutes, you would, burn like 80 calories. And I thought, well, who's going to sweep for 30 minutes? Like, how big is your porch? 30 minutes?
I would just delegate that job.
Wait for the wind to come through and blow it away. Number four, helping out others, which is sort of a vague thing, but if you were to help somebody with their yard work or home maintenance, moving
would be a huge one.
So, it makes you feel good when you help somebody, and you can lose some weight. Also, and then number five, gardening. So if you're a gardener, that can help you lose, burn some calories as well. So kind of interesting. Here's a funny story. I love this one. Of course this happened. Kansas police set up wildlife cameras to catch a mountain lion. This is what they got instead. They thought there was a mountain lion roaming around, so they set up like an infrared camera to find out what was going on. It was not a lion. But people knew that they had put the cameras there, so they decided to have some fun. The police department in a small Kansas city got more than a bargain for when it set out to catch a mountain lion using wildlife cameras. Officials with the Gardner Police Department set up two trail cameras around Celebration Park after concerned residents reported a mountain lion sighting. But when officials looked at the footage, they found images of jokesters dressed up as a gorilla, a coyote, and a dog. According to the authorities. But they thought it was fun. They actually liked it. They said, "We are glad to report that over the time they were up, we did not see a mountain lion. We were, however, surprised by some of the images that the camera did take." They said, "We would like to sincerely thank the persons responsible as it made our day. When we pulled up what we expected to be hundreds of pictures of coyotes, foxes, and raccoons, thank you to the citizens who notice the cameras. Your effort and sense of humor are greatly appreciated."
That's refreshing. It's a good, clean joke.
So people said, "Hey, they're setting up a camera," and then one guy dressed up like a gorilla, and he walked by it, and then, like they said, a few other things. One person showed up dressed as Santa Claus, and another person dressed as an elderly person standing in front of the camera with a walker for an extended period of time. So
this really has nothing to do if you're just going to stand there for a long time.
Well, I just, you know, I appreciate the joke, but I'm like, wow, that takes a lot of time and effort, you know, to do something like that. But that's what's going on in Kansas. Nothing to do in Kansas, I guess.
It's encouraging people to get outside, though, you know.
Maybe they'll start a new trend. You find, like, public cameras, and you put on a costume and stand in front of it. Very interesting. Two new Key of David programs this weekend here on KPCG. Make sure you listen for those two new programs that will be coming up here in a little bit. And you can find them online at kpcg.fm as well. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Talked about a few topics, including Germany creating a nuclear umbrella. Europe, I guess, but Germany really involved there. And details about Donald Trump's deal to keep Carrier in the U.S. Is it what it seems, or is there more to it? And a few other topics as well. Make sure you listen for that program. And if you missed any this week, you can catch up at kpcg.fm. All of them are archived there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live with myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau stopping by. And you can follow us on Twitter at KPCGFM. Email us comments at KPCG.FM. Abraham, how are you doing today?
Doing pretty well.
You didn't dress up, for any of the security cameras that might be around, like
well,
you did in Kansas.
I prefer to keep that private matter.
You keep your costumes a secret
yes,
and hidden.
That's correct.
I wonder about those people. You'd have to drive there with like part of the costume on and then put the rest of it on. And I'd be worried somebody would see me and think, why is that guy dressed up like a gorilla? Or shoot me with like one of those tranquilizer darts.
It could cause some sort of a panic because a lot of the time when people commit crimes, they conceal their identity.
Yeah.
So who knows?
What would you do if you were walking in the park and you saw like, somebody dressed up as a gorilla? Like, I don't know. I'd probably just stay away from them, I guess.
They'd probably think it was Hammurabi and
the one
that they voted for in the election.
Harambe, yeah.
Yeah, right. Harambe, that's Hammurabi.
I think you're talking about an Egyptian.
He's a Babylonian.
Oh,
king,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
Well,
that was a very in-depth,
thing.
Very yes. in-depth joke there. You really have to know your history to get Abraham's wit and wisdom. Yes, that would be like the ancient Egyptian king. Abraham, you do have a good story for us here from foreignpolicy.com. This is something that's in the news today. Francois Hollande won't run in the next election, so we're looking to see some new leadership there in France.
Yes. The article is Au Revoir Hollande, and on Thursday he did announce in an unprecedented TV address that he will not be running for a second term as the president of France, and he's the first French president not to seek re-election since the end of World War II, and there's a lot of reasons why he isn't seeking re-election. Among them is a 4% approval rating, which is one of the lowest in, I think, world history for a politician, 4%.
Yeah, how do you what if you're one of his aides and you got to bring him the report, like in the month before it was like 16% or something. He's like, surely it couldn't go any lower.
What's the worst we've ever seen in America? I thought low 40s or high 30s was bad.
Yeah, I think it's been around bottom of 40%, like near 40%, but
4%.
It's 4%, and it does remind me of a scene from Canadian Bacon. It's a movie with John Candy and Alvin Alda. He's the president of the United States seeking re-election, and
John Candy is awesome.
He has an aide with him, like his advisor, and his name is Mr. Smiley, I believe. And there's an assassination attempt on him. He's like, oh great, assassination attempts always help raise the approval ratings. He's like, well, a failed one raises your approval rating by 2%. A successful one would have raised it by 10%.
That's true.
Let's try that one next.
That's true. Well, yeah, it's. Can you imagine if we came into work, all of us, when we had the approval ratings like every week, where the staff voted?
Oh, no.
You're like, wow, really? 6% people think I'm doing a good job. That would be a real shot to your confidence, especially as a leader of a nation.
Well, exactly, and especially in France, which is one of the two major powers in the European Union, Germany being the other major power, especially with the UK set to leave. And so this is pretty serious, because if there's a leadership crisis in France, they're the main counterweight to German dominance, and we've already seen that eroding. But this, as we'll see, I think is opening the door for a more friendly or more right-wing government.
I just have to wonder, too, who are those 4%? I think, he's doing a pretty good job. Like, was it a mistake? Did they circle the wrong box? Or?
Hopefully he's not a spiteful guy, because if it's like 4% only like him now, he's like, well, I'll show you how to dislike me, start doing some things that'll hurt the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's stepping down. He's just going to, and then when's the election? It's in
I believe it's next year. So
yeah.
I don't know the exact date.
So he's
date,
got, yeah, talk about a lame duck administration, right?
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Well, I think the 4% were the barbers across France.
Oh, right.
Because the story we talked about on KPCG when it first came out, but he did spend $122,000 on haircuts over in 2016.
That's incredible.
And he also, a book was published by a former aide in which apparently he insulted everyone from his own ministers to footballers. So anyone that had really met the president, he just had insults for them, and he just was very rude to them. So someone published this in a book, not really hit his popularity as well. And if we remember as well, it's been under his presidency that the attacks in France and Nice have happened with the Islamic State. And I think that's the main issue, besides economic, because France is still in economic slump, is the issue of terrorism and immigrants, and how if you look in videos and pictures of Paris, there's just immigrants everywhere in the boulevards, sleeping in boxes, sleeping bags, tents. And so the city of lights, as it's called, is becoming just a slum. And I think that's a big reason why people are tired of his leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how it's changing. I mean, it's changing in Europe. It's changed here in America with Donald Trump getting in. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens in Germany, what happens in France. The face of Europe is changing, and it's going more toward the authoritarian type leaders. You know, your Putins of the world and so forth. Those leaders seem to be more popular. Of course, how would we know if they weren't, right? But still, they have a hold on power, whereas a lot of others are starting to lose it. So it's a real real change in terms of the leadership style.
Yeah, I think this is he's the first domino to fall in Europe. Of leaders we've seen for a long time, of a particular kind of leader, brand of leader that we've seen in Europe, more central, sophisticated, very polished type of leader. And I think he's the first one we're seeing this trend where we're moving from a socialist spectrum in Europe more towards a right wing. And right now for the election, a man named Francis Fillon, sorry. He is leading the polls. He's a conservative. People are calling him the French Margaret Thatcher, which I think is ironic.
Poor guy being called a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, they meant that in the best way possible. Leadership style.
And he wrote a book, Fillon, he wrote a book called Conquering Islamic Totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And he has a 66% vote over Le Pen. So the other one is Marine Le Pen. She's the nationalist leader, and it's this conservative. He's in favor of free trade, more anti-immigration than Hollande was, and he's really captured most of the people who would vote for Le Pen. And I think what's interesting is that his power base is in the Catholic conservative part of France, and that's a huge majority. And so I think this is a trend in Europe where we're seeing religious groups having more power, and Europe reverting more to, let's say, religious conservatism, religious views going into politics more so than before. And when we talk about the election in Germany coming up, Angela Merkel running again, and other elections throughout the EU countries, if this Francis Fillon is elected, I think we'll see more right-wing anti-immigrant leaders elected.
Well, yeah, we're seeing more nationalism, and those that I guess were globalists or were into globalism, that's not popular because you have the influx of the Muslims. We talked earlier today about this shock poll out of the UK from the Muslims in that country where they want, I think 40% or so wanted Sharia law. Almost 50% said they wouldn't report somebody that was involved in terrorism or extremism. They wouldn't even report them. So there's all these different ideologies coming in, and well, mainly two, I suppose you could say, Christian and Islamic, and they're butting up against each other. And people at the end of the day, they want their nations to be strong, and they want them to be successful. And so it seems like people, like we talked about the other day, younger people especially, they're getting rid of the idea of democracy. They want solutions to their problems, and I think they see the solution as a strong leader. And but that also has problems that come along with it, as history has shown.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Today in history, Napoleon Bonaparte crowned himself Holy Roman Emperor. He's really the last leader of France that people still hold in reverence, even though he was a dictator. He was a great Frenchman, and he did really create. He was the last man to really make France into a great power when they were respected, when French culture flourished under him. And so it is interesting to contrast a leader who has a 4% approval rating on this day to Napoleon, who even after everything he put the French people through, when he returned from exile, people flocked to him as a savior. Not everyone, but most of them did. And they still view him in that romantic, heroic light. And so it'd be easy for someone to come in with a Napoleonic spirit or resurrect that kind of imagery to in a, some kind of leadership to pull France out of the slump they've been in for so long.
Yeah, and it's interesting because if let's say Fillon gets in, or somebody that's stronger and more anti-immigration, you know, Europe, they do need their coalitions. They do need, like, they need to work with each other. And so if you have more leaders that are that way, somebody like an Angela Merkel, she's going to struggle because, unless she changes her thinking, but I don't think she will. You can't have one nation sitting there saying, we disagree with all of our neighbors. Let them all come into our country. The people are not going to accept that, I don't think, because they're going to look across the border and say, hey, they're keeping people out. Why do we have to take them all? You know, that's just natural for that to happen. So you could see, like you said, if a domino falls, then they all start to go because they're all going to want to go that way, having a stronger leader.
Yeah, exactly. I think with the elections in France, I think we're going to see a big political revolution in Europe, but a more subtle one. It's not going to be, I think, as obvious right away. But and that's how the way it usually works. Usually political revolutions start in France and sweep through the rest of Europe. I think that's going to happen again. And the main place to watch would be Germany because they are the ones who hold the power of the economy in the EU, and even they're the main impetus behind the military revolution going on in there as well. So with Angela Merkel not backing down from her globalist and pro-immigration stance, it'll be interesting to see if she survives the same kind of voting cycle that Hollande is just completely collapsed to.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if he even finishes out his term.
Yeah.
I mean, how long can you drag this? You know, maybe he's hoping by coming out and saying this, people say, okay, you know, we don't like him, but let's let him finish up. Maybe he'd try to relieve some pressure on himself, but I don't know. You know, if the cries get strong enough to get him out of there, maybe he'll just take off.
Yeah, that's always a possibility, especially with people still, with Brexit still on the mind, where and Le Pen becoming or going closer than ever before to actually winning some elections. It will be interesting to see and to see if there's more terrorist attacks or some kind of national crisis, that forces the French government a more forceful measure.
Yeah, well, they've come out with a whole new list of targets that ISIS is going after there in Europe, and so wouldn't be surprised to see that. It'd be interesting to see what does happen, but there's a lot of things changing over there. You can read about that at foreignpolicy.com. What's the title again?
Au revoir, Hollande.
Au revoir, Hollande. Mm-hmm. I can't do a French accent, so I didn't even try.
I just have a Canadian accent, so.
Are you part French?
Yes.
Yeah, you got some.
I am.
How much?
About a quarter.
Okay.
Around there.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So you've got a quarter of a French accent.
Yes. You only hear it on every fourth vowel.
Right. You have to listen very carefully. It's a very unique system. Grant, you've got an interesting write-up here talking about, changing of power in elections. Of course, that's happened here in the U.S. Couldn't have two parties more different, I suppose, in some ways than the Clinton side and the Trump side there with the liberals and I guess you can call them conservatives, somewhat conservative. This from the Washington Post. Shouting match erupts between Clinton and Trump aides. They're still battling it out.
This was a really exciting article for me to read, actually. They just basically had this meeting where all of the top aides from each campaign and then even from a lot of the other campaigns that didn't make it quite as far this year all got together, and it was sponsored by one of the groups at Harvard University. Apparently, they've had these post-mortem election discussions after every election since 1972. Generally, the discussions are characterized by frank yet civil discourse, but this time it was far different, as you can probably expect because of how emotional this campaign was.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect them to be buddies now after, especially some of the aides that were working there, because they don't have to put on like this, you know, a diplomatic front as a leader. They can really let it fly, and but they just don't like each other.
They really don't, and they really did actually start shouting and throwing out some pretty crazy yet hilarious accusations at each other. apparently the Trump team was basking in their glow of victory, and they actually continually praised specifically Stephen Bannon of Breitbart, the one who obviously the Clinton side is convinced is a white supremacist somehow. Right. So clearly they were trying to point out a specific area of irritation for the Clintons.
Yeah, and that bothered them, I guess. It really did.
It really triggered them.
You talk about people having like a button, like, well, don't. That's kind of their trigger button. Don't do that. They were hitting it with their full fist over and over.
They sure were. Yeah, the Clinton communications director Jennifer Palmieri said, "If providing a platform for white supremacists makes me a brilliant tactician, I am proud to have lost. I would rather lose than win the way you guys did."
Oh, sure. Sure you would. Right. Right. That's always what they say in those closed-door meetings when they're trying to win at all costs. Well, winning's not the thing. It's about holding to our principles. Yeah, right.
Yes, and then Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway was actually triggered by this white supremacist accusation. She said, "Do you think I ran a campaign where white supremacists had a platform?" Palmieri responded, "You did, Kellyanne, you did." And apparently she was choking up at various points throughout this.
Boy.
She was on the verge of tears throughout this exchange. Conway actually had a great comeback, though. She said, "Do you think you could have just had a decent message for white working class voters? How about it's Hillary Clinton? She doesn't connect with people. How about they have nothing in common with her? How about she doesn't have an economic message? And one of Clinton's chief strategists said that there were dog whistles sent out to people for the rallies. So I don't know if that's a racist connotation there. But once again, they go back to calling people they disagree with bigots instead of focusing on themselves and why they failed.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you can win or do very well on some sort of a white supremacist platform. I think the big issue that they miss, and of course, they're not going to admit any error even in losing, but the big issue that they miss is that people are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about they liked the message of Donald Trump, whether or not he can actually do it. But they like the idea that, hey, let's make America, but return it to its glory days. Let's improve the economy. Let's improve the trade deals. Now, that's a tall task. Can it be done? Well, doesn't look likely. But people responded to that message much more so than responding to some sort of message about, hey, everyone's a racist and a bigot. Like, how? There's a lot of people that were called the basket of deplorables and all of that. That's not a positive message. Nobody wants to hear that. People want to hear nice things. Now, that's not always the truth. That's not that they want to hear the truth, but they want to hear something positive. And the one side had more of a positive message. And that's just, I think, why people voted that way.
The incredible part is the Clinton aides actually accused the Trump side of having the incredibly negative campaign. Their entire campaign, the Clinton side, was the negative one. I mean, they were the ones whose biggest goal was to make Mr. Trump look completely unelectable, completely unacceptable, unqualified as president. They downplayed their actual beliefs on the issues because a simplification of that is just that they wanted to follow in Mr. Obama's footsteps and be his third term in office, which clearly people didn't like, but because that's what Mrs. Clinton wanted to do, they couldn't talk much about it. They couldn't talk about the issues because the people have already spoken. They don't like those issues very much.
Yeah, and they were concerned about the breaking of laws that she was involved in on a national level. So people were concerned about that. And again, I think, people are they want to hear a message about becoming strong again. It's like France. What do French people want? They want to be a strong nation. I mean, everybody wants that. Nobody wants to sit there and beat themselves up. And everybody wants to be a strong nation. I think those are the messages that are resonating around the globe. Russia wants to be strong. Iran wants to be strong. Germany wants to be strong. The U.S. wants to be strong. People respond to that.
Yeah, because we're not all racists, apparently, which is what they think.
Yeah, nobody wants to sit around and, kick themselves. You want to be successful, right?
Well, that's the funny thing about those who take liberalism to an extreme, like I think you can say President Obama's administration, other people in the background. And that's because it's self-defeating, because you undermine your own government, your own system of laws, your own identity. Because the Constitution, America, and foreign policy, those are our two biggest identities, internally and then externally, how the world views us. And we've seen over the past 8 years, and I think every president hasn't necessarily done a great job at this necessarily, some better than others. But when you completely erode away everything your nation stands for, how people identify with America, and just make yourself a laughing stock on the world, people don't want more of that. And even if, for example, I think America was war weary after the Iraq War, and so they supported President Obama scaling back military adventures or military operations around the world. However, once people saw the result of that, the lack of respect, our reputation falling, and just the disasters happening around the world, I think people realize, like, oh, that was actually a bad mistake, and he took it too far.
That's even been brought out by some more liberal commentators. They said the PC culture, just they undercut themselves. Everything had to be so politically correct that people just get sick of it. Even if you look at a population and you say you have made mistakes, and every population has, just think of it personally. Do you want somebody to remind you of the mistake you made every single day for the rest of your life? You're like, okay, yeah, I heard you. You know, you want to move forward. Everybody wants to do that. And so this constant browbeating of the main population of the United States, surprise, surprise, people didn't respond well to it.
This shouldn't be a surprise at all.
I should be running campaigns. What am I doing?
Yeah, it's just...
Well, I'm doing the recount, so I can't do both.
You're getting paid the millions of dollars
millions
for the
dollars.
Recount.
Yeah.
Yeah, people need to realize, especially on this Democratic side, why they lost. They're blaming the fact that the FBI said they would reopen the email investigation days before the election. They're blaming the fact that a lot of young voters turned to third party candidates right before the election because they were so sure Clinton was going to win anyway. That doesn't address the issues of the fact that Hillary Clinton is a career criminal and by far the most corrupt person we've ever put into either party's nomination. That is a pretty big issue that they're trying to downplay and say that, well, the media gave Trump all of this free press and they gave him all of this free exposure that Clinton didn't have. What about the fact that Clinton never held a press conference? She never wanted to talk about her views. She didn't campaign as much because she was sick a lot. Yeah, a lot of different things that they really should turn to themselves for and see why they went wrong.
Blame the officials every time you lose a game. They didn't call out penalties. That's
exactly what it is.
Yep, there's always got to be a winner and a loser. Nobody likes to lose. So kind of interesting write up there at the Washington Post. I don't think they're ever going to get along, but maybe they will someday. That'll do it for us on this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for being with us. And make sure you listen for the Trumpet Hour Weekend Review Program. Key of David. And the Trumpet Daily Radio Show all coming up. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.